Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 4th of February, these are our main stories. Hopes of an HIV vaccine are dashed as a major trial in South Africa is ruled ineffective. Democrats in the US make their first formal choice over who should face President Donald Trump in November. And the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei speaks out about his decision to leave Germany. Also in this podcast, China's top leadership body makes a rare admission of guilt over the coronavirus outbreak. And indigenous leaders from the Amazon call for help to stop violence and deforestation.
Money, money.
We indigenous people need support so that the Bolsonaro government doesn't attack us.
First, it's estimated that almost 40 million people worldwide are living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. There's no vaccine, but for the past few years, hopes have been pinned on an experimental trial in South Africa. Those hopes have now been dashed after an independent evaluation of the trial found the vaccine was ineffective. It's a blow for South Africa, which has one of the highest rates of HIV in the world. Here's how the trial was reported by South African media in November 2016.
All eyes are on South Africa in the latest and some say most promising effort to develop an AIDS vaccine that prevents the disease. It is only the seventh full-scale human trial for a virus that infects more than 2 million people and kills more than 1 million every year.
23-year-old Nkosiyazi Nklube from Inanda, Durban, received his jab this morning, as well as 29-year-old Ningi Primrose Mbuto, also from Inanda, Durban. A truly historic moment.
The president of the South African Medical Research Council, Glenda Gray, says the trial's failure has left her feeling catatonic. 129 participants who received the vaccine became infected, a larger number than those who received a placebo. So the search for a vaccine continues, as I've been hearing from Linda Gail Becker of the International AIDS Society, who told me more about the trial.
It was based on that very large Thai study, now known very well as the RV144 trial, which was run by the US military and the Thai partners. And that showed a 50% reduction in HIV incidence at 1 year. Actually, the reduction in incidence was thought to be as high as 60%. Now, that is very encouraging and exciting. And it was based on that data that the HVTN-702 trial was designed. We took exactly the same regimen, modified it for the southern region, added a few tweaks to, if anything, increase potency. And so I think the optimism was well placed. It was based on some evidence. And I think over the next weeks to month, we'll try and unpack why we think we've ended up with a result that looks different to what was found in Thailand.
And is there anything useful that comes out of it? In other words, no doubt work continues to develop another vaccine that might be subject to another trial in the future. Is there evidence that comes out of what we've learnt here that you can build on, or will it really be starting again?
Well, it's important to just remind the listeners that we actually do have other efficacy trials in the field at the moment. So not all is lost. It does mean that this regimen is probably not going to go forward in any shape or form. And as I say, I think what we will be going back to the drawing boards on is whether this kind of approach is one that we want to pursue in the future, whether this sounds the death knell for this particular approach.
And just give me a sense of the scale of HIV in South Africa and in the world at the moment.
Well, that may be a clue to what actually has happened on this occasion. So, in fact, the incidence rate that we saw in the participants who were involved in 702 is almost 14 times higher than what occurred at the time that the RV144 trial was being conducted in Thailand. So in this region, the epidemic continues unabated and in extreme proportions. And so there is no way that we can actually give up the fight for a preventive HIV vaccine.
Linda Gale-Becker of the International AIDS Society. In 9 months' time, voters across the United States will decide whether President Trump gets a second term in the White House. Today, the first formal choice over who should face him is being made. It's the Iowa caucus, where candidates, including the former Vice President Joe Biden and his left-wing rival Bernie Sanders, do battle over who should get the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. First, let's remind ourselves what is a caucus. And why is it sometimes compared to the winter sport, the luge? The BBC's Mariana Brady has this explainer.
Every 4 years, as with the Winter Olympics, the world becomes obsessed with, and self-declared experts in, an event they know almost nothing about.
Iowa caucuses, folks. Iowa caucuses.
All you really need to know about a caucus is that it's not like a normal election where you go to a polling station. It involves people attending a meeting, maybe for a few hours, before they vote on their preferred candidate, perhaps via a head count or a show of hands.
5, 6, 7.
But unlike a private vote, people declare their support in front of their friends and family. There is lots of debate and haggling for support.
How stressful is this?
Very stressful.
You want to come? I'll give you a little sticker on the way.
Both the luge and the Iowa caucuses take place on frozen terrain, and they're all about gaining momentum. So how important is this place in the race for the U.S. presidency?
Thank you, Iowa!
Well, since 2000, every Democrat who won here also went on to win the nomination. The problem for Democrats? In that time, only Barack Obama went on to win the White House.
Mariana Brady. So who are the candidates and what hope do they have of defeating Donald Trump? Our correspondent Nick Bryant reports from the Midwestern state.
The Iowa caucus can sometimes feel like a wintry Woodstock for political junkets. But at this stadium rally in Cedar Rapids, packed with more than 3,000 people, Senator Bernie Sanders was feted like a pop idol by his adoring young supporters.
The next president of the United States, Bernie Sanders!
The 78-year-old one-time socialist suffered a heart attack in October, but he's generating more energy and enthusiasm than his rivals. In what's become a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party between the left and the center, it's his radicalism that's become the lifeblood of his campaign.
We are tired of the massive income and wealth inequality, where working people are working longer hours for lower wages, and almost all new income and wealth goes to the top 1%. That is going to change.
The divide in the Democratic Party right now is not just ideological, it's generational. This 78-year-old attracts a young hipster crowd. The edge of the stage looks like a mosh pit. Many of his supporters look barely old enough to vote.
I feel like a lot of the things that he's going to do are going to impact my generation. Like, we have a future ahead of us, and if we don't, like, for example, he wants to take care of our planet. And if we don't do that, then there's not going to be a planet left for us to live on when I'm older.
I personally am a little bit tired of old white men in government, but, you know, out of all of our options, like, America's probably going to vote in an old white man, so it might as well be Bernie.
So I hope you'll choose, as I did, rock solid with Joe Biden, and here he is.
The former Vice President Joe Biden is another old white man, a soft jazz sort of candidate, easy listening moderation that appeals especially to the old.
Thank you.
His audience at this Masonic Hall in the sleepy town of Mount Pleasant was mainly gray.
8 years of Donald Trump can fundamentally change who we are. I really mean it in a significant way. And our kids are listening. Our kids are at stake here.
He's a pretty uninspiring speaker, but comes alive when face-to-face.
I'm working, how are you?
Genial, empathetic, with a smile that could light up a dark room. He reckons likability means electability, and he's selling himself as the candidate best able to beat President Trump.
Mr. Biden, it's not worth the BBC.
Thank you.
BBC, I'm Irish.
What are the chances? You're Irish.
I think my chances are good.
This is no time for small ideas.
Like her friend and longtime ally Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren is on the left of the party, She's the leading female candidate in the race and aiming to break the most resilient glass ceiling in politics.
This moment is our moment to dream big, fight hard, and win.
Mayor Pete.
And Pete Buttigieg wants to become America's first openly gay occupant of the White House. A product of Harvard, Oxford, the US military. It feels like he's been rehearsing for this moment for most of his 38 years. In a field crowded with septuagenarians, his youthfulness is his calling card.
I am a little worried that a message is going around that's telling folks you got to choose between the best way to govern and the right way to win. I'm here to insist that the right way to do both of those things is with a focus on the future.
A question uppermost in many people's minds here is which candidate can defeat Donald Trump in November. For the past 60 years, it's been moderate Democrats who've won the White House. Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, Clinton, and Obama. But might the voters of Iowa opt for the radicalism of Bernie Sanders?
Nick Bryant with that report. We'll have full reaction to the result in Iowa in the next edition of Global News. Now, some of the most prominent indigenous leaders from the Amazon have written to the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, urging him to stand with them in defending the Amazon. The letter, delivered in person to the Prime Minister's office, claims that President Bolsonaro of Brazil is encouraging the invasion of their lands, the theft of natural resources and violence. One of the leaders is Rayoni Metuktire, chief of the Kayapo people. He's been campaigning to conserve their territory for decades and became internationally known in the 1980s through the work of the musician Sting.
I'm here again, fighting to preserve the Amazon rainforest and my land, and also my people. Today there is a lot of deforestation, and I'm very worried about it. I want to conserve the forests and the rivers in our land. But in order to do that, I need help. We indigenous people need support, so that the Bolsonaro government doesn't attack us. It wants to open up our lands to mining and loggers. We are extremely worried about this. We don't want him to open up territories to anything. Mining, coal mining, or logging.
Rayoni Metuktire. Fiona Watson works for Survival International, a group that campaigns for the rights of tribal people around the world. She explained the link between these people and the protection of forests.
I think it's an extremely fundamental and important link. We know from all the scientific data coming out of the Amazon and, in fact, other areas, that tribal peoples are the best guardians of the forests. So if you look, for example, at satellite images coming out of the Amazon rainforest, it's very clear that where you have the indigenous territories which have been recognised as indigenous, you have the primary forest standing, and outside where you have the pressure coming from the loggers and the miners, the forest is in various stages of deforestation. These people are wonderful conservationists. They're zoologists, they're botanists, they're doctors. And this is all fundamental because it feeds into conserving the Amazon for the benefit of humanity. It acts as a carbon sink. And of course, we know with global warming, that's essential. And of course, they say we're doing this not just for us, the indigenous peoples, we're doing it for the benefit of humanity, for the planet. And I think also we need to value human diversity. You know, people are concerned about species disappearing. But here we have this fantastic, you know, indigenous peoples, this wonderful relationship, this knowledge. And they too are disappearing. They're being killed. There are genocidal attacks happening. I know of a case where we have the last member of his tribe alive because all the rest of his tribe in the last 50 years have been killed. We've seen attacks increasing on indigenous peoples. Many more invasions of their territories. And when I was there recently, indigenous people told me that loggers, for example, invaded their land, the Ure Wawao. The loggers said, we can do what we like because President Bolsonaro is in power. But also, we have a great responsibility here. The UK government, not just the Brazilian government, to make sure this gold is coming from legal mines, not coming at the cost of indigenous people's land and rights and their lives.
Fiona Watson. In 2015, China's internationally famous artist Ai Weiwei fled to Germany after his human rights activism landed him in jail. Since then, his criticism of the German state has grown, peaking in August last year when he was asked to leave a contemporary art gallery after staging a spontaneous protest on social media. He's now living in the United Kingdom and he's been speaking about his decision to relocate.
I have been in Germany almost 5 years, and I gradually sensed German culture, not German people, just like people anywhere can be friendly or can be not so friendly. And it really depends on individuals. But a German culture, deeply, is a society which are not accept new ideas or different argument. And the clear example is why 2015 did this film in Human Flow, which I did the film only because I'm in Berlin. I'm in the center of this discussion about refugees. When I made the film, a lot of criticism about the film, forget about the issues the film is talking about. German media more work does either one way they love you or one way they hate you. They don't have discussions. They don't have much mixed idea. I stayed there for very long. There's not much discussion about China. And there's no much discussion about Hong Kong uprising. It was such a huge, huge revolution in Hong Kong last past 6-7 months. But there's very little discussion because German in favorite with China. They have a huge business with China. The leader of Germany, the top leader, visited China 12 or 13 times. It's more than me visit China. I mean, I have mom in China. How could she love China so much than me? This is all about business.
Let's talk about China. What is your relationship now with the Chinese authorities?
I have a Chinese passport. And if I go back to China, I may cause this corona disease. And my mom is still in China.
She's in Beijing, is she?
Yeah, she's in Beijing. Every phone call, every day I'm calling her. And her last sentence is, do not come back. You know, she's old and ill. And my first priority is to buy the next flight ticket to go to China. But she insists, do not come back.
Why does she say that?
For my safety. She cannot afford to lose me again, and the authority will never tell her where I am, what kind of crime I committed, and how long I will be sentenced. So for those reasons, really she suffered. You know, she is the wife of the most patriotic poet, and she's very respected, but it's the same.
I wonder how you think the rest of the world should engage with China.
It might be too late. China offers the biggest market and the laborers. And it's not easy to pull out. In China, we say a sentence, you can ride the tiger, but you cannot get off from the tiger because they will be eaten. I think the West is riding this tiger, and they all had a problem how to get rid of it.
Ai Weiwei speaking to my colleague Razia Iqbal. Coming up in this podcast...
Islamic State wanted to silence these voices, but music is a vital part of Yazidi culture.
The women from northern Iraq determined to preserve their culture and traditions. And the latest on a wave of drugs entering southeastern Bangladesh. Now for the latest on the coronavirus, with more countries closing their borders with China, global markets bracing for an economic downturn, and complaints of racism and paranoia across the world. First, a rare admission of guilt from China's top leadership body, the Politburo. It says the epidemic has exposed the government's shortcomings and deficiencies. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
It was a rare admission of wrongdoing by the seven men who sit right at the top of China's ruling Communist Party. Headlining the state news agency website, a speech from the Chinese President Xi Jinping admitting that more must be done to ban illegal wildlife markets, where the virus is believed to have originated, and to improve the public health system. Beijing is scrambling to show it's doing all it can, amid persistent criticisms on Chinese social media that it's failing. More than 8,000 hospital staff have been sent to the virus epicenter in the province of Hubei, though many local citizens still complain that they're struggling to get medical attention.
Celia Hatton. In Hong Kong, there have been 15 confirmed cases of the virus, and the city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, has announced the closure of all but two border crossings with mainland China.
One of the keys to controlling the epidemic is to reduce substantially the flow of people between the two places. In other words, we are not just talking about mainland visitors to Hong Kong, but also Hong Kong travellers to the mainland, and the number of commuters must be reduced substantially both ways.
Carrie Lam's decision to close most borders came after hundreds of medical workers took strike action, warning hospitals were already overwhelmed. One Hong Kong doctor, 27-year-old Benjamin So, has quarantined himself inside a hotel to protect his family.
After I treated two patients with suspected novel coronavirus a few nights ago, they were later confirmed to indeed be some of the first cases of the new infection in Hong Kong. And although I was in full protective gear at the time when I saw these patients, I was still worried that there could be a small chance that I could have been exposed to the virus. And I didn't want to put myself or, more importantly, my family and friends and the rest of the community at risk.
Benjamin So. And as global concern about the virus increases, so too do reports of discrimination against people of East Asian heritage. Lucy Lee is a paediatric nurse in London. She says her niece has been bullied by classmates.
So she's beginning to hear more and more children say to other children, don't play with Chinese kids specifically because they carry the virus and they're all infected with the virus. And what really prompted me to come forward is when I heard my 14-year-old niece come home on Friday and in tears. And yeah, she was basically ganged up upon by her friends saying that she's caught the virus and now she's spreading it around the school. But at the moment, I feel that the public isn't going into unnecessary panic and paranoia. And for us Chinese people, there is nowhere to turn when we experience something like this. And it's very sad that it's even a topic to be discussed. It's turning into a safeguarding issue amongst Chinese children.
Lucy Lee. Now to Bangladesh, where more than 20 accused drug traffickers have surrendered to the authorities as part of an amnesty ceremony in the coastal town of Teknaf. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ethiranjan, has been telling me more about the wave of drugs entering southeastern Bangladesh.
Bangladesh is a Muslim majority nation, so alcohol for generally most Bangladeshis is prohibited. So as a result, you know, these kind of drugs have started coming into Bangladesh in the last 10, 15 years, especially from across the border in Myanmar, what they call as Yaba tablets. It's methamphetamine. It is produced in local factories across Myanmar. Inside the Myanmar territory, what is happening is because the borders with Thailand and other countries were tightened in recent years, they were looking for a new market and Bangladesh was there with a huge population.
That's very interesting to think that although alcohol would breach Islamic law, these kind of drugs don't.
Many students previously used to drink what they call as a fencidil, a cough syrup. You know, it was very cheap, it was easily available, and they used to drink to get high. But then came the Yaba tablets from Myanmar, and I've met parents of some of these students and youth who they complain of addicted to these Yaba tablets. And it is available in plenty because there are many people doing this trade and it is lucrative for many Bangladeshis. So this has completely taken over the southeastern part of Bangladesh. And with the arrival of the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, it made easy for the drug smugglers to send these tablets through some of these refugees and Rohingyas moving across. And that's why the government started what it called the war on drugs. And hundreds of people have been shot dead on what police describe as shootouts, which the rights groups say are extrajudicial killings.
And it sounds from what you say as though people acknowledge this is a real problem in Bangladesh. Do they therefore support what the authorities are doing?
Initially, there was widespread support because many of the middle-class families, many of the villagers thought drugs should be taken out of streets. But then, you know, they started realizing that these kind of shootouts, they were occurring more and more frequently. And then the rights activists started questioning whether this is the right way to proceed, whether this is, you know, legal, whether the government is starting any inquiry into these kind of shootouts. That became a big question in Bangladesh, but it doesn't affect many Bangladeshis. What they want is to stop the drugs coming to the street. You know, every month they are confiscating millions of these Yaba tablets. And that's why the government is determined to put an end to this drug menace.
Anne Barrison, Ethirajan reporting. Here in Britain, the volume of contactless card payments has risen by a third in the past year. And with that, the range of things we pay for, not just cinema tickets and endless kinds of coffee, but street performers, even how we help homeless people. To that end, the people who run The Big Issue, a magazine aimed at raising funds for the homeless, say a trial involving their vendors has been a success. And that may reassure those who worry that the cashless society could exclude some, as Paul Moss reports from London.
Big Issue, eh? Big Issue.
It was definitely one of his better days. Cold, perhaps, but at least it wasn't raining, as Dave Martin stood outside a supermarket in West London, selling, or at least trying to sell, copies of The Big Issue.
Big Issue.
Dave's been selling The Big Issue for more than 8 years, but for the past 11 months he's been involved in an experiment, trying out a new way of getting people to buy the magazine.
How's it going today?
Well, I've managed to sell one. It goes like that. I average one or two an hour.
Now, you have got a sign up here which says you accept contactless payments. How's that working?
That gives me extra sales. I mean, sometimes people will say that they've got no cash, and I say I take card. 9 times out of 10, they'll pay for an issue by card.
Are people surprised that a Big Issue seller is working with contactless payments?
I do get quite a reaction. There's one woman, she couldn't stop laughing.
She was laughing?
She was laughing because she was shocked more than anything.
Now, also with us here in West London is Beth Thomas, who runs the contactless card programme for Big Issue. Beth, why did you decide to get contactless payment for Big Issue sellers?
More and more of our vendors are reporting that their customers are saying to them that they weren't able to purchase the magazine because they weren't carrying cash. And it's a lot more than just giving people another way of being able to sell the magazine and for the customers to pay. It's helping teach digital literacy. We have to show our vendors how to set up cashless. And they don't necessarily have bank accounts. So vendors, through being able to have a bank account, they can start managing their finances better. They'll have email addresses. It has opened up the opportunities for vendors to move on and move back into mainstream society by gaining digital skills.
Contactless payments certainly are part of mainstream society. In Britain, we now collectively tap our cards 200 million times a day. Two-thirds of adults use contactless. But that does mean fewer people bother to carry cash.
Getting by today, just getting by.
Charlotte Campbell also struggled with people not having spare change. She is a full-time busker.
Singing ba 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 ba, there's music on the streets of London.
Charlotte is another whose solution was to join the world of contactless payment. Though, as far as she's concerned, investing in card-reading equipment was just one more way in which musicians have been forced to embrace new technology.
I didn't want busking as an art to die out just because people don't carry cash. So I thought, you've got to give people the option to donate in another way. I do see people sort of nudging each other and saying, she's got a card reader. I can sort of read their lips, and I know that they're sort of joking about it. But it's mostly quite positive and funny, and it's all sort of in jest.
But doesn't it in some ways take something away from the ideal of busking? I mean, there you are. You're supposed to be out on the street playing your guitar and with your hat out. And instead you're now part of the banking system. I mean, what next? You're going to accept American Express?
I suppose in some ways I think some people feel it takes a little bit away from the romance of dropping a coin into the hat. But I think, you know, you have to develop ways in order for people to show their appreciation and move with the times.
I've moved now to Covent Garden in central London, a popular site for buskers, but I've also passed a couple of Big Issue sellers on the way, and it has to be said, there are quite a few beggars around. They certainly can't take contactless payments. You wonder how they fare in a world where many people no longer carry cash. But I'm just going to ask people passing by how they feel about the tap and pay method.
It's just easy, and you don't have to worry about your PIN number, and it's quick, it's efficiency. And I can even keep it in my pocket and just waft my pocket in the general direction of it.
You sort of bump your pocket against the reader, do you?
I do.
I do everything contactless. Because it's convenient.
How do you feel about giving money to one of these street performers here with a contactless payment?
That wouldn't bother me because it's verification. It's through you, and that's fine by me.
Are you a fan of contactless payments?
I am a fan of contactless payments. It's quick and easy.
but I would not use contactless on the street. I would use cash on the street. Just don't feel right. I'm old-fashioned.
People in London there on whether contactless cards will consign coins thrown into a hat to a nostalgic dustbin. Finally, a choir of young Yazidi women from northern Iraq has travelled to the UK as part of a project to preserve their culture and traditions. The Yazidi people, an ethnic group with their own religion, were subjected to a campaign of genocide and sexual violence by the Islamic State group. Today, the choir has been rehearsing some of the music it'll perform during the visit. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley was listening.
Islamic State wanted to silence these voices, but music is a vital part of Yazidi culture, and it's been an important part of the recovery of these young women, some of whom were kidnapped by IS. Reynas was 14 when her village in northern Iraq was attacked. She was taken to Syria, sold several times, and repeatedly raped. She told me she didn't think she'd ever recover, but she feels happy when she sings, she says, and the companionship of the choir is a psychological boost. This is all part of music therapy for the women, being organised by a charitable foundation called Amar. The violinist Michael Bockman has been out to the camps in northern Iraq, where they now live, five times.
At the end of the teaching session, so they don't want to go back to their tents. Music makes you live in the present. You forget about the past, forget about the future, you just enjoy the people around you. It gives them incredible confidence. They're smiling, making music and enjoying each other's company.
He's also helped document the ancient religious music of the Yazidis, which has never been written down until now. More than 100 recordings of Yazidi religious and folk music have been given to the Bodleian Library in Oxford. They'll be presented by the young women who survived IS, who want to ensure that their precious traditions are never lost.
Caroline Hawley with that report. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.